All right. Well, thank you so much to the Foodscapes organizers for having me here, and thank you all for being here. I'm really excited to share some of my recent research on the unique effects of hydroelectric development on Anishinaabe women's abilities to feed their families. Today, we're going to look at how hydro created an environment that allowed methylmercury to accumulate in the Winnipeg River. Then we're going to talk about how the introduction of methylmercury changed breastfeeding practices on reserves along the Winnipeg River. We're going to zoom in on Ochichagwe Babigonin First Nation, or Dolls 38C. Our goals today are twofold. Number one, I'd like to determine with you how hydroelectric development, particularly White Dog Dam, which was built between 1955 and 1958, reshaped Anishinaabe women's reproductive labor in the Treaty 3 District. That's in northwestern Ontario and southeastern Manitoba. I'd also like to consider Anishinaabe women's labor as a lens through which we can understand environmental challenges to tribal sovereignty and the increasing Anishinaabe reliance upon federal programming in Treaty Number 3. At this point, you may be asking yourself, where is Treaty Number 3? So I'd like to take a quick moment with you guys, and we'll take a peek at this map. Treaty Number 3, the eastern border, it's about 1,580 kilometers northeast of Guelph, according to Google Maps. If you guys wanted to go on a road trip, we could hop in a van and make it in about 18 hours. So the elders whose voices we'll hear today are from right here, Ochichagwe Babigonin. The mill who polluted the Winnipeg River, the mill that polluted, it's actually here in Kenora, Ontario. This is only about 8 miles difference. So who are we going to hear from? What are my sources? We're going to rely on elder testimony that was collected by Sheldon Ratuski. He researches Manaman out of the University of Manitoba. Jennifer Leeson, she was an American who came down and studied community trauma at Dolls 38C or Ochichagwe, and then myself. So, what were Anishinaabe women's household responsibilities? According to Elder Dan Pine, women's work included learning how to manage the household. He said, "A young woman is taught everything, how everything works inside, how everything is managed." Part of what we had to learn how to manage was our children. How do we feed an infant? When do we feed an infant? And what moss makes the best diapers? These tasks were shared through the maternal line. In the words of one elder at Ochichagwe Babigonin, "Your grandmother would teach you. Your great-grandmother. Mostly your mother turned you over to your grandmother." One of the most important jobs a young Anishinaabe woman might perform for her family is nursing. Women were taught to prepare for this job young, and they learned about the medicinal potential of their bodies. Women were taught that breast milk is just one medicine their body would come to produce. A woman's body was seen as a sacred body. Why? Because like Earth, a woman's body had the ability to generate life. We can see these conceptual linkages in sweat lodges. The link between pregnancy and power is made manifest by Anishinaabe sweat lodges. According to Cree elders Eric Robson and Henry Quinney, sweat lodges have been designed to mimic the body of a pregnant woman. Men used to go through sweat lodges to pass symbolically through the womb of a mother. It was believed that by passing through the sweat lodge, you would renew your body, would be regenerated, reborn. A sweat bath provided a curative, offered relief for stress muscles. Women use sweat lodges less frequently because their bodies cleanse themselves monthly. Women displayed the inherent ability to renew themselves. Female bodies were medicine bodies. So perhaps it's no wonder that breast milk, which passed through the body, was also seen as a medicine. During the first few years of an infant's life, one of the most important jobs an Anishinaabe woman performed was providing her infant with this medicine. According to researchers Joan Dodgson and Roxanne Struthers, breast milk is a gift from the Creator and a medicine a mother gives to her child. Given its medicinal quality, breast milk was recommended over other known alternatives throughout the first half of the 20th century. Anishinaabe women chose to breastfeed over providing alternatives like manamin soup, wild rice soup, assuming they were capable, and carnation milk, which was pushed really heavily by the Department of Indian Affairs. Given the importance of breast milk, perhaps it's no wonder that a number of rules emerged around breast development. Girls born between 1930 and 1950 were raised under the assumption that they would come to breastfeed. Given the importance of breastfeeding, girls were provided with a series of maternal teachings to encourage the future flow of breast milk. This was unique to Anishinaabe communities at the time because there was a real scientific push to formula feed. It was believed that formula was best for raising healthy children. Anishinaabe women rejected these scientific claims, and when they chose to breastfeed, they made their bodies a site of resistance. Breastfeeding was an act of resistance. Rules surrounding breast care existed around these scientific trends towards formula feeding. And then they developed around the use of hunting tools. Elder Alice Kelly said, "My mom used to say, 'Don't even touch.' I don't know what they call those, slingshots. And I don't know, a bow and arrow. 'Don't touch those.' 'Why?' I'd ask. 'Your breasts. They're gonna drag your breasts.'" The first time I heard this, I was totally confused. I had no idea what Alice meant by drag your breasts. So I asked her to map this for me on her body to show me. And Alice took her hands and she dragged them from her collarbone down to her ribs. And she let me know that using a bow and arrow, this action would flatten your chest. So it's unclear whether or not Anishinaabe women feared that they would create a boy's chest. By using the tools, they would make a man's body incapable of lactation, or if they would prematurely sag the breast, shaping a postmenopausal figure. Either way, it was feared that using a bow and arrow would reshape a girl's body, modify the breast, and create a figure incapable of lactation. So, given that we have these rules around growing healthy breasts, perhaps it's unsurprising that we had a lot of rules around pre- and postnatal diets. It wasn't just about growing healthy tools. We had to oil them. So there were a lot of teachings around the consumption of wild food. It was believed that if you ate wild food, your infant wouldn't drain you of energy. It wouldn't be able to suck you of the power you need to be a mom. So the diets were also designed around the assumption that whatever the mom took in, the baby would take in. So moms had a responsibility to eat nutrient-rich fish and game. Dodgson and Struthers found that manamin was highly recommended for Ojibwe women in Minnesota. Hilger found in northern Wisconsin that Anishinaabe women were encouraged to eat venison, wild rice, lake trout, and whitefish. My findings in treaty number 3 parallel most strongly with Hilger's research. Where I'm from, white fish soup is considered the most important component of a postnatal diet. According to Elder Alice Kelly, "My mom breastfeed us, all of us. All she used is white fish soup to have milk on her breast." But just as easily as breast milk could be enriched with white fish soup, it could be tainted by ingesting the wrong type of food. Bad diets were believed to compromise breast milk production. Taboos, for example, existed around the consumption of turtle. Young girls weren't supposed to eat turtle meat. Alice Kelly explains, "We weren't allowed to eat turtle soup. Just the old people. We used to peek and watch them, me and my friends, my relatives. They looked, but don't eat it. You'll kill your virgin, your reproductive health. That's what my mom told me. You ruin where the baby is." Taboos existed around turtle because of the belief that turtle was an emissary. Turtles live on land and in water, and it was also believed that they could cross over between the physical plane and the spiritual plane. So if you ate turtle, this creature that lives between worlds, the infant spirit may be tempted to follow turtle out of the physical world and back into the spirit realm. Because of the importance of white fish soup to breastfeeding, breast milk production, mothers placed extraordinary emphasis on teaching their children and grandchildren how to make white fish soup. Pastor Carol Lawson, as a young girl here with her grandmother, Matilda Martin, remembers her grandmother, Matilda, putting extraordinary emphasis on making white fish bouillon while her four children were young. Carol would pick Matilda up from the nursing home for dinner, and every time Matilda came over, she would insist on teaching Carol how to make white fish bouillon again. She'd act as a head chef, but she wouldn't allow Carol to be a passive observer. Carol explains, she would always have to clean it, the white fish, right from the beginning to the end. And every year it was like she'd never done it in front of me before. Like I didn't know anything about making fish bouillon. She would have to show me step by step how to scale the fish, how you cut off the head, as if it were the very first time. Carol was carefully taught and retaught how to make white fish bouillon. The dedication Matilda showed in teaching her granddaughter to make white fish bouillon reflects the importance she attached to it. While her granddaughter was raising four young boys between the years of 1953 and 1960, that's when they were born, she was provided with the key to infant health. Matilda made sure that her granddaughter, Carol, knew how to raise healthy breasts, that she had the potential, ideally, to produce breast-quality breast milk. She also had the tools to know how to feed them. At this point, you may be wondering, Brittany, how is it that hydroelectric development affected breast milk production? Fair enough. Alice Kelly was taught how to breastfeed, but her daughters were not. During Alice Kelly's growing up years, her daughter's growing up years, Alice's maternal teachings lost their potential. For the first time, white fish soup became poison along the river, and these general teachings we just learned no longer rang true. I was never taught how to make white fish bouillon because it's recommended that I don't eat white fish from the Winnipeg River where I grew up. My dad's afraid that I'll bioaccumulate methylmercury in my system. So how did this happen? Prior to hydroelectric development, Winnipeg River, where Ochichagwe Babi Goinin is located, was known for its rapids. And these rapids worked like a giant aerobic composter. The mill was active in Kenora since the early 1900s, and it had dumped its solid wood waste into the Winnipeg River for years, long before 1950. But those rapids turned the piles of wood waste, and it broke it down before it was allowed to taint the riverine environment near the reservation. The rapids were important because it meant that these aerobic composting bacteria had enough oxygen to break waste down. Do any of you guys compost at home? Yeah? Okay. So you might have to like turn the piles, or there might be a dropping of floors, and that's so those same aerobic composting bacteria can eat up your garden waste or kitchen waste. In 1950, this river changed. The rapids were blasted to create a reservoir in anticipation of a dam. So the rapids were gone. We weren't getting as much oxygen. But, the river wasn't dammed, so it was breaking down across space and across time, and waste wasn't allowed to settle in front of the reservation. It just sort of floated by in a temporarily solid form. In 1958, however, when the dam was completed, solid wood waste settled in front of the reserve. It had nowhere to go. It was stuck in that reservoir. And we have more of it now because the dam allowed the mill to double production. So for the first time, we have more waste than there's oxygen available to break it down. And those aerobic composting bacteria can't do their jobs anymore. But they have cousins in the river, anaerobic composting bacteria that thrive in low oxygen environments. And it was the anaerobic bacteria that took over the composting of wood waste. And these cousins, sulfate-reducing bacteria, release methylmercury into the environment as a natural byproduct of decomposition. So they do their jobs, the anaerobic bacteria take over, and they're releasing this methylmercury as waste. And it gets into the tiny bugs at the bottom of the river, and then smaller fish eat these tiny bugs, and then bigger fish eat the smaller fish, and eventually we eat it, and it bioaccumulates up the food chain. By the 1970s, the risks of eating from the river were so great that women were taught they should no longer eat wild foods. An elder who asked to remain anonymous said, "I remember a nurse came with a doctor. They told us not to eat game, fish, not to eat any of those things anymore that we got from the river. That they were polluted with mercury and waste from that paper mill. It was terrible." By 1970, the river had become toxic, and women born in the 1950s who were likely having their second or third child could no longer eat in ways known to produce best quality breast milk. So what did this mean for women's infant feeding practices? For the first time, Anishinaabe women changed their tune about the healthfulness of wild food. For the past 20 years, Anishinaabe women had rejected the scientific push to formula feed. They were determined that breast was best, and the body became a site of colonial resistance. But environmental change affected Anishinaabe women's ability to control how they fed their children. So in 1970, women started putting a lot of energy into re-educating the youth. Grassroots posters were released by Grand Council Treaty No. 3 to declare that breast milk is poison. Children at schools on reserve, like Grassy Narrows School, were taught for the first time at home that Anishinaabe foodstuffs could be poison. This is a story by Tony, a Chopinist from Grassy Narrows School from 1973. And we can see through this that women's re-education efforts were effective, because Tony, as a child, came to understand that the dangers of the river were often invisible. Tony could clean his backyard. Talks about his backyard here. He could pick up papers, bags, boxes, and bottles. But even in Tony's childhood fantasy of being a well-paid employee of Treaty 3, he felt that the invisible danger of methylmercury could not be remedied. His last sentence here, "but there's still mercury pollution." Just like Anishinaabe mothers couldn't see the damage their diet had on infants, children were taught they couldn't see the damages or the dangers of the river to themselves. But they were taught that these invisible dangers were as real as a pop can. Children raised in the late 60s and early 70s, unlike their mothers, were taught that whitefish could harm them. Breastfeeding slowly left the community, and these rules around breast care, around whether or not you could use a bow and arrow, slowly disappeared with the introduction of carnation milk. It happened. So the dam has clearly jeopardized women's abilities to feed their infants. The methylmercury forced Anishinaabe mothers to rely increasingly on federal institutions to feed their families. In the 1970s, there's a massive spike in welfare applications and welfare provisions, and we have carnation milk being shipped out to the reservation. It's used as infant formula. In response to the high demand now being made for canned milk, the Friendship Center in the town of Kenora requested additional funding for infant formula, and it received it. They explained that milk was in increasing demand at the Friendship Centers because mothers believed that their breast milk was poison. But I believe that this increasing reliance on carnation and milk substitutes isn't necessarily a declensionist narrative. It's true that we have seen the disappearance of traditional rules surrounding the gendered use of bows and arrows. but mothers establish new childcare routines. Today, in Treaty 3, it's widely agreed that carnation cans make the best jingles for jingle dresses. So today, we dance for our health. And as our breast milk becomes poison, we, the women of Treaty Number 3, turn those carnation cans, that sign of our dependence, into regalia for healing. Miigwech.